this is Angelica Owens.
And Tamara Bell.
And our second podcast will be focused on chapters 3, 4, 5, and 6 of How to Log Statistics by Daryl Huff.
Okay, so the focus of, and the recurring theme that we have observed in chapters 3, 4, 5, and 6 is that the theme, something that we see a lot is about graphs and figures and how the media or how like newspapers and things like that, how they produce these figures and graphs and how they can be very misleading because sometimes they may skew the results. And so that's a recurring theme that we're going to talk about in this podcast. But first, we're going to open up this podcast. We're going to start it off by talking, by reading two quotes from the front cover of the book, How the Lie of Statistics. So Angelica will be reading the two first quotes.
Okay. So the first quote is, "There are three kinds of lies, lies, damned lies, and statistics," by Disraeli, and then "Round Numbers Are Always Fake" by Samuel Johnson.
So, those two quotes, we will be connecting them to the introduction of this book. So, the first quote, where it says there are three types of lies, lies, damned lies, and statistics, we interpret that as that there are people who lie or whatever, but one way, because this book is about statistics and lying with statistics, one way that people can lie is by using statistics. And basically saying, you know, what they want, basically people who use lie with statistics, they're basically using statistics to get people to believe what they want them to believe, and although it may not be true.
And we'll talk about that more so with our graphs that we'll bring up in a few minutes.
Yeah. And also, we interpreted round numbers are always false as, you know, people round numbers, or in this instance, use averages. And sometimes the averages always aren't the best for most situations. And so round numbers are always false. We interpret that as, you know, that's another way that people lie with statistics, because sometimes when we round the numbers, they always aren't as accurate, or they don't accurately represent the population that is being surveyed. So we're going to connect that with the introduction. So Angelica, you can start off by connecting those two quotes with the introduction.
Basically, in the introduction, you know, they're pretty much talking about, you know, lying, you know, with statistics and whatnot. And they're talking about a secret language of statistics here in page 8. And here it says the secret language of statistics, so appearing in a fact-minded culture, is employed to sensationalize, inflate, confuse, blah, 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 and then statistic methods and what. Yeah, and then it talks about, you know, writers and how people use the words with honesty, understanding with readers who know what they mean. So pretty much, you know, it's talking about how people use statistics to deceive people, and that, which connects back to the first quote, and that people can justify it with the manner of the type that burglar who has published reminiscences, accounts or goes of course in how to pick a lock and make a football. Cooks are the most right. Okay, so the cooks already knew these tricks. Honest men must learn them in self-defense. So in that sentence there, they know what they're doing before they actually do it. So they know what they're doing, but you guys or the audience that's watching them or listening to them don't know. Also, there's a picture of, in chapter 1 here, of a scientist with a glass thing, pouring solution and whatnot. And then it has the book title of How to Lie with Statistics. So it's pretty much talking about how statistics, it's kind of like a science experiment, if you would put it that way. And you have all the ingredients, and you know
that you're lying about whatever you're talking about, but the audience doesn't know because they're not with you.
Yeah, and also, the author Daryl Hoff, he starts off by talking about how when he moved to a certain area, he moved from Iowa to California. He and his father-in-law read a newspaper article. It said that the crime rates are going up, and so that newspaper article used statistics to say that. And so his father believed that crimes were going up because it was statistical in the way that it was presented. And so he goes on to say that even though the sample says that crime has gone up, however, the way that it's the way that the survey that the statistic is based off was conducted, it did not represent the whole area. It only represented it was only a small group that they did it with. But if the survey had collecting more data on the whole total area, the results would not have been as blunt and as extreme. And also, when he talks about in the introduction, he talks about how people use their words to lie with statistics, and like those. And I will talk about that more later, but people will, say some things or title their graphs a certain way so that it stands out and that it goes to extreme measures. And but we'll talk about that later. But that is how these quotes connect to the introduction, because people lie with statistics, and that's a form of a lie. And also, by rounding the numbers and by having these small group or populations and not really taking a huge population and huge samples to survey and conduct an experiment with, that's like false rounding and lying using statistics. So now we want to go to page 18 of How to Lie with Statistics. And we want to read the second paragraph, an excerpt from the second paragraph, and then we're going to summarize that to you and tell us how it connects to this book.
I want you to know we're on page 18. This is the second paragraph that I'm about to read. A river could not, we are told, rise above its source. Well, it can see into if there's a pumping station concealed.
So this quote right here, it says a river cannot, we are told, rise above its source. Okay, so that means, so basically this quote is saying, although it may not be true, it's saying a river cannot rise above its source. Meaning, a river can't, overflow or flood. It cannot rise above, where it's at. And it says, well, it can seem that if there's a pumping station concealed somewhere about. So it's saying that it's possible that it can rise above its source if it has a pumping station hidden somewhere around it or under it. And so, so what this quote means, if you're wondering how it connects to statistics, is that your statistics is as true as your study is true. So, the author goes on to say that it's equally true that a result of a sampling study is no better than the sample it's based on. Meaning, the results of your study, for instance, if you have a toothpaste, it says this toothpaste is two times better than something, or it reduces cavities by this much. It's only as good, the truth is only as good as your study. So if your study says that, this toothpaste gets rid of cavities or doesn't, that's your results, and that's how good your sample is. However, through manipulation and things like that, you can pump up your study to make it seem better. So, and do underlying layers. So, say the toothpaste gets rid of cavities. Now, the people who would do it, they have to have cavities. And that means that you have to take a survey on people who have cavities. And so, that's just, you have to get a huge population and see, the people who have cavities and those who don't have cavities. And, and use that toothpaste and see if it gets rid of the cavities now, or if it prevents cavities. And that can be very complicated because you have to have people, on a certain diet and things like that. And
they just give it a certain diet and things like that. And so, and like eating certain things or brushing as often and using certain toothpastes. So it's very difficult to have the control. So oftentimes people, the companies who conduct these research studies, it will be very skewed and very targeted towards what they want you to believe and targeted towards wanting, they'll skew the results to making you want to buy their product. They make, they're trying to pump it up and make it seem really good. So, Jennifer, what is your thought on this?
Yeah, I agree with what you said. It actually connects to my graph, which I'll talk about now. So, the graph that I have, which I will, you know, have the link in the description. So the graph here is titled "Percent Who Agreed with Court," and so for this graph, it's talking about Democrats, Republicans, and then the Independent Party, and it has, you know, the percentages. So it makes it seem like that the Democrats. Okay, so first off, it's labeled from 50% to 64%. And Democrats is 64%, and Republicans and Independents are 54%. So, but the way the graph is showed, when you look at it, it makes you think that the Democrats is way above the Republicans and the Independents, when really, they're only, like, 6% away. So, but you wouldn't know that by looking at it. So this is a prime example of how you can lie, because it's all about like your like the way you set up your graph and different numbers. Because if you look at it, you know, you'll think one thing, but then when you really dig into it and actually look at the results, then you'll think another thing.
Yeah, and something that is very current in the graphs, even with my graph, the misleading graph that I have chosen talks about the alarming rise. It talks about the rise in gun violence and gun deaths in Florida using firearms. So it is a graph. I mean, it's a graph, and it's going from the years are from 1990s to 2015, and so it's showing the gun deaths in Florida. And what's particularly interesting about it is first of all, it's a scatter plot, and so something that is often common in misleading graphs is that that they always change the y-axis. So in this case, in the instance of my graph, it's very weird because the graph is in descending, and it's in descending order instead of ascending order. And so the graph starts at 1,000 on the y-axis, and then it goes up to zero. So it's actually inverted and changed. And it's making you think, and it looks like, it's making you look like the gun violence has increased, especially in 2005 when Florida enacted Stand Your Ground law. So it's saying that the gun violence has increased. And then decrease, and then increase, and then decrease again. Where in actuality, the gun violence has decreased if you actually invert the graph. So it's showing the misleading, it's just misleading the viewers, because it's trying to make you think that the gun violence has decreased, when it actually is, it's pretty much stayed the same, because it went from, it just dropped down by like 700 deaths. I mean, by 100 deaths. But however, it hasn't really been a significant change ever since the Stand Your Ground law was enacted in Florida.
So now we're going to flip over to chapter 3. Okay, so it starts off talking about that 23% fewer cavities are reported to happen if you use Dope's toothpaste. It also goes on to say that you could do with 23% fewer aches. So, you know, people use that toothpaste. Now, Samira, what's your take on that?
Well, first of all, this is something that we see oftentimes. Like, a lot of brand still say, for instance, you take the Bounty brand, they're like, it's 3 times tougher than your average or your store brand paper towel. And then she's using statistics. So this is an example that we often see in like media and the consumerism market, in the market, our marketplace. So like, and this is a way that companies, they get you to buy their products because they make it seem like their products are so much better. And they say, compare our product to your store brand or blah, something like that. So, but my take on this is that, first of all, these results were done by, a reassuringly independent laboratory whose account is certified as a public accountant. And so that just makes you think that, okay, yeah, these results are true because it's done by an independent research company and they're public and they're not public company. But in reality, they're actually getting in with the company. And they're making the results seem, the company is basically paying them to do these things, like to make the results, make the results what it is so that we buy it. And you know, that's not right. Like, why do people, I don't understand why should people, you know, have to lie to persuade us to buy something or do something just because they think that the actual data isn't good enough for us. I mean, like, for this example, I mean, okay, so it depends. Okay, so 23% fewer cavities, but what's the actual percentage of the cavities before? Is it 80%? Because if it's 23% fewer, then, you know, I would like for it to be 100% fewer. Why is it that little bit of amount fewer cavities using this particular toothpaste? It's not, me personally, I probably wouldn't buy this just because if I look at the actual number or actual percentage of cavities that are known, that this amount, 23%, isn't big enough for me to be like, oh, let me go out and buy this toothpaste now because I'm not going to get cavities. Yeah, and also, here's the thing about what they did to get this. First of all, it says 23% fewer cavities, and how is that even possible? So that means that the sampling group that they did this research on, first of all, they had to come in having cavities. And you don't know the intensity of the cavities, you don't know what type of cavity they had, where the cavity was located in their mouth. And it also says that it had 20% fewer cavities, so that means that this toothpaste obviously got rid of their cavities or even prevented it. So it's very skewed because the toothpaste can get rid of your cavities. And you have to seek a dentist for that, and they only fill your cavities, they won't get rid of it. So that's one thing about this. And also, this chapter is just talking about this. Like, it's talking about the importance of a small group, because when you use a small group, it's more likely that the results are going to be very different, very skewed. For instance, Angelica, do you want to talk about the test with the queens?
Okay, so for this experiment that they're doing with the pennies, they had 10 pennies, and so if you want to flip it, you have a 50-50 chance of getting either heads or tails. And if you flip over two of them to the tail side, then the science proves that tossed pennies come up heads 80% of the time. And if, you know, the bigger sampling size you have, the better the results will be, and the more accurate the results will be. If you have a smaller sample size, like Tamir stated previously, that there's not as much data and not as much, you know, information to say that the information is accurate and that it's gonna come out right, and, you know, so yeah.
And then it also just gives you, by having a small data group, by having a small group, a sampling group, it gives you it just allows you to have misleading data. If you have a bigger group, a larger group, there's less likely of a chance of having, there's less likely a chance of having inaccurate data, inaccurate results. And by having a smaller group, it just makes your data misleading. And you can skew your data by having a smaller group to the way that you want it to be. So, for instance, if they had used 100 pennies in this sampling case, then it would have been more likely that the flip a coin, you would get 50% head, 50% tails. It would not have been 80% heads and 20% tails. So the bigger the group, what's this top, this chapter is trying to talk about, the bigger the group, the better and more accurate the results will be. So now let's talk about the next a study in Chapter 3. So in Chapter 3, there was a polio study conducted in the, I think, 1920s or 1930s. And so basically in this study, they, it was in a community. So they looked at 450 children who were vaccinated in community and 680 kids who were left unvaccinated in the community. So it said that no one of the vaccinated children had contracted the case of polio, but neither did anybody who was not vaccinated. So this experiment just said that like nobody, it didn't matter whether you got vaccinated or not, but it did not really look at, because this was such a small group, and because polio is not, it's like probably two out of every like case, or every 10 people, or like one out of every 10 people, or whatever, that people actually get polio, that this wouldn't really help in such a small group, because not everybody's going to get polio. And so they had to get a bigger group. So maybe if they use the total people in the U.S. and see how many people got polio who were vaccinated and were not vaccinated, then they would be able to get better results. So the next thing I want to talk about in Chapter 3 was about
So the next thing that we want to talk about is Gasser's norms, which is so say, you know, a parent reads an article somewhere where they, you know, like their child has to reach certain milestones at this particular like age, like maybe at 8 months they're supposed to be able to know how to walk or cry or whatever the case may be. So, and you know, and what if their child doesn't meet those requirements? Then the parents are thinking that there's something wrong with their child, that their child is retarded, blah blah blah. Or if they are meeting the milestones that are set out for them in the article, that their child's a genius. But really, they shouldn't listen to what they hear or what they like read in the article, because that's, every child is different. You, especially like if they have premature babies or, you know, stuff like that, they aren't going to be developed as fastly or as quickly as other babies are, because they weren't born at a good age. It's setting their child up for failure also, just because, you know, if their child's not meeting those requirements, then the parent will grow up with their child and, you know, call them different names, like, oh, you're stupid, you're retarded, why didn't you meet these things, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, then the child starts feeling bad about themselves and stuff like that. But then, if they are meeting the requirements, then their parents will think they're a genius, and for the rest of their lives, they'll have to get straight A's, and they'll put their child under so much stress. And, you know, stress is, you know, one way of just people dying, because the special teachers are very stressed out with life and school and, you know, all of that stuff. So it's not good to listen to what the things you read, because you don't know if your child or someone is going to meet those requirements or not, and then what that does on the child or on whoever this case study is on, you know, how that's going to affect them and their lives.
And also, even if the child, so say that the child has met, I mean, say, let's take the opposite. So say that the child has met those milestones of the article that the parent has read about, and so now the parent thinks the child is advanced. So that, you know, kind of makes the parent create the child and say, oh, my kid is better, or whatever. So basically, you know, we have to be aware of these articles and marketing and markets and how they're trying to fool us. And so Daryl Huff, he says that one way that we can avoid being fooled is not by like every man being his own statistician and studying raw data for himself, but basically it's just like being able to, you have to be able to report how likely a test figure represents the real result, and rather than produced by chance. So meaning like, so we have to think about like how the results are, we have to always put in mind like whether these results make sense, and we have to think about how much people were surveyed and how does it represent the whole of the group. So that's chapter 3.
So now we're going to go into chapter 4. Okay, so now we're going to move into chapter 4. So in the beginning of the chapter, first off, this chapter is talking about intelligence and measuring intelligence and how, you know, the wrong things of it. So the beginning of the chapter talks about Peter and Linda, and they're doing IQ tests. And Linda's IQ is 101, and then Peter's IQ is 98. So, you know, of course, the normal, or that IQ is based on 100%, or 100 as average or normal. So they're saying that Linda is the brighter child and that Peter is the below average child. So whatever an intelligence test measures is not quite the same thing as we usually mean by intelligence. It neglects important things such as, you know, leadership and creative imagination. You know, by taking an IQ test, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're smarter than the person next to us. It just means that maybe we're just better at taking tests than the other person. And maybe, you know, so we shouldn't, you know, dwell on the fact that our IQ is higher or lower than the average person or someone else next to us, because then that will make us think that we need to, you know, be smarter, test harder, and, you know, stuff like that.
And also, if you're looking at this, basically, yeah, in this study, they're saying that Linda is, because her IQ is 101, and Peter's IQ was off by only 3 points, that Linda is smarter than Peter. But basically, the IQ test does not properly assess intelligence. It barely assesses intelligence because of the fact that it does not include many of the important features of intelligence, such as art, such as critical thinking, such as leadership, such as being able to work with people, and things like that. So it only tests how well you take the test. And that's very common with like taking the SAT or the ACT. It's only basically testing how well you can take the test and how well you can read what's in the test and how fast you can do it. So it's not properly assessing knowledge. And so just because he's right under the average, they're saying that Peter is below average. And this is common with like some students, personally me. Like first, when I first took my SAT, I was right below the average. And so that means that I'm below average in the SAT, even though I've came very close. And so that just gives a bad rep for the student, or for in this case, for Peter. And so This is also the same with Dale Huff goes back to the example that he first used in the beginning of the book about the income of a Yale student. It's saying that, you know, that anyone who attends Yale will definitely earn $25,000 a year. And so this income is not, it's just like the IQ test. It doesn't properly assess income, because income is, so Dale Huff then goes on to talk about the Yale study. He says that the study said that anyone who attends Yale will earn $25,000 a year. And so this income is just like the IQ test. It does not properly assess income, because just like the IQ test did not properly assess like creativity and all those other things that determine intelligence, neither does this study about Yale, because there's other things than just a job that gets you income. So just by using these tests, it doesn't assess the whole of the map.
So now we're going to talk about chapters 5, the Judas graph, and also chapter 6, the one-dimensional picture.
Alright, so basically, the Judas graph, it talks about the presentation of a survey using a graph. So in this chapter, we start off, if you look at the picture in the graph, we start off with a normal graph talking about $1 billion. It has like a guy, and it has like $1 billion in the graph. And so it looks like a graph that's pretty linear and very straight. Now it says that what people and advertisers tend to do is that they will skew the graph. They will shorten the y-axis to make the graph look shorter. And then they'll spread the y-axis out so much to make the graph look simple and shorter. And not only that, but and this skews the results because it stretches off the y-axis so much. And
so chapter 6 talks about the pictorial graph, and that's something that something like a drawing of a small man. So the pictorial graph is a drawing like a small man. That means as 1 million people to draw a bag of money. To me as $1 billion. And so also in the book, the author has pointed a finger on how the tricks are used to manipulate the report or give it a desired direction. If there's no additional information that's mentioned, then it shows that by a small money bag and of other people in the bag 4 times larger than the first one, where the income is only approximately double of that first group of people. So as there's no additional information that's mentioned, readers will see that the income of second groups is also 4 times larger than the first group. So, okay.
And also, like, in the end of chapter 6, there's a pictorial graph called the Cressif Column. Basically, it's saying, like, in 1860, there was, like, slightly over 8 million milk cows in the U.S. And it says by 1936, there were more than 25 million. So by, like, having these pictorial graphs, it basically shows, like, how much more they have in cows they have, and I say so it's like showing the increase, but oftentimes it's exaggerating the topic in the manner that's being discussed. But it's just like a hasty manner. It's just a way that advertisers try to get you to believe what they're trying to put out there by exaggerating things. So using pictorial graphs often exaggerates the manner that's being discussed. So that's it for this podcast for chapters 3, 4, 5, and 6. We hope you enjoyed it, and see you next time.